Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 266. More on hypnagogia with Jerry Trumbull. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional. Well, surprise everyone. I'm putting out this episode just 2 days after the previous one. So you should think of it as a special treat, and consequently, I'll leave out my usual announcements, commentary, and reading of the email. Instead, we'll get right back to my conversation with my longtime friend Jerry Trumbull about his adventures in the land of hypnagogic phenomena. Jerry Trumbull, welcome back to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Hey, Dr. Dave. It's good to hear from you again.
Well, you are back. What can I say? You are back by great public demand and acclaim.
Okay.
Yeah, I've gotten a bunch of emails getting on my case saying, bring Jerry Trumbull back.
And, wow.
Yeah, and I know that you didn't get to finish all your thoughts on, I guess, what you came to call hypnagogia.
Yes. Indeed. In fact, listeners may recall that we started off talking about quantum consciousness.
Right.
And the Hameroff theories and so on and so forth. And then we kind of segued into dreaming and hypnagogia, that mental state between wakefulness and dreaming. And I had a bunch of thoughts because I've been practicing that for years and kind of wanted to espouse my particular version of that phenomenon, and we never quite got around to it, so perhaps this is the time, huh?
Yeah. Maybe you could start off just by very briefly recapping how you personally go into that state, in case we have some listeners who are just joining us for the first time and didn't hear the earlier interview. And then you can just go wherever you want from there.
Yeah, in fact, that's exactly my plan. I'd like to actually step back a little bit from dreaming and say a few things about sleep in general. Because I've noticed in the popular press, especially at the Huffington Post, that they're putting up all this stuff about sleep deprivation and most people aren't getting enough sleep. And I think that's very true, but they don't seem to have gotten down to what I consider to be some essentials. First of all, I wanted to mention a little experiment from years ago when I was living outdoors. When I left the University of Toronto and came to Denver, there was a period of 3 months when we didn't have a house. We were living out of my van and traveling around the country trying to find a place where we were going to live.
That was before we talked about homeless people, but
right.
You might have fit.
Yeah, I was homeless in a sense. And after a lot of going to California and Oregon and Colorado, we eventually picked Colorado, and we set ourselves up at a campground here locally. And from living outdoors, I learned that the sun is the critical element in that mixture, because I couldn't stay awake after the sun went down. About 9 o'clock at night, I would be so tired that I just had to go to sleep, and then I would wake up when the sun came up. And that was my natural circadian rhythm taking control. And I realized that part of the problem is we have all these electric buzzers. I call them buzzers because they operate at 60 cycles. And You know, the light bulb, of course, is the big one, but radio, TV, internet, cable, whatever you want to talk about, it's an electric buzzer that keeps us awake and makes us think we have more important things to do than sleep. And right. somehow sleep gets relegated to a category of, catch as catch can. And we don't, we stay up till midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning, thinking it's really important that we watch the last episode of this TV series. And actually, it's not important at all. And we're putting off a critically important sleep that controls so much of our lives that we have no idea. I mean, for example, the immune system seems to be put at risk when we don't get enough sleep. I don't know that anybody's really tracked down why it works that way, but at any rate, as a nation, we're all sleep deprived. I used to notice this with when my granddaughter was 10 years old. As soon as she would get in a car, after a couple of miles, she would fall asleep. And then she would sleep the whole time we were driving. And I realized that she was, at 10 years old, she was sleep deprived. And I think this is a bad state of affairs. And so I would admonish listeners to take their sleep time as critically important.
That's an interesting perspective that I haven't heard articulated quite so forcefully as you've just put it. And it also reminds me of an earlier interview on sleep where we talked about also being dark deprived, that it's hard to find true deep darkness in our country these days.
Exactly. I call it ready kilowatt stalks the land.
right.
Everywhere you go, there's these street lights lighting everything up to keep crime at bay. And I don't think it really works, but it's just a reason for spending more money on electricity. But anyway, so we got a bunch of sleep deprived people setting alarm clocks. And that's another thing I want to honk on a little bit. alarm clocks should be banned. I'll say more about that later, but the part of sleep that doesn't get discussed in these popular venues is the 90-minute sleep cycle. It's a cycle that runs 24 hours a day, whether you're sleeping or not, and it becomes very important when you're sleeping. And I want to say a few words about that 90-minute cycle. Just to mention, when you're not asleep, approximately every 90 minutes, you'll feel a wave of drowsiness. In fact, I remember as a young man, when driving long distances, I could feel this 90-minute cycle affecting me. And for males, especially apparently young males, you may experience an erection every 90 minutes. Do you remember that?
No, I do not remember that.
Well, it's part of this 90-minute cycle. Anyway, it's cycling along, whatever you're doing, and your attentiveness or drowsiness waxes and wanes during this 90-minute cycle. Okay, now it's dark and it's time to go to sleep. If you learn to appreciate your own 90-minute cycle, you'll know when to go to bed. It's not an arbitrary time. In fact, you mentioned this concept of catching the wave.
Yes, yes.
To get in sync with your natural cycle. And since we've been talking about this, I've been paying a lot more attention to my own habits, and I discovered that my bedtime is 10:30.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And I've started going to bed regularly at 10:30, and I've started keeping a more accurate dream journal. And by the way, I don't mind waking up at night. Some people seem to believe that a good night's sleep is like 8 hours solid of non-waking. But it's actually five 90-minute cycles. And EEG records show that the first cycle is mostly slow wave sleep. Then there's a little bit of REM sleep, which I think we should just call dream sleep. I know it's not 100% correlation, but let's just call it dream sleep. And then there's a slight wakefulness there. And most people, if they're videotaped while they're sleeping, it just shows people turning over, assuming a new position, and then getting back into slow wave sleep again. Okay, then you're on your second one, which would start at midnight. And that's also slow wave sleep predominating over REM sleep, maybe a little bit more REM sleep, but it's also just a 5 or 10 minute REM sleep period. The third one would start at 1:30 and the fourth one at 3 o'clock in the morning. Now they say don't have a clock by your bed. Well, I think that's a mistake too, because I've learned to actually wake up during these, in between these cycles, and I look at the clock and it's precisely 3 o'clock in the morning.
Yep.
Or 1:30 or whatever the cycle time is. And I'm just going like, okay, now I'm in for round three or round four. Well, by the time you get to round four, the percentage of REM sleep starts to increase dramatically. And then round five, which for me starts at 4:30, is what I call the feature film.
Because it's a
90-minute, pretty much unbroken stint of REM sleep. And I look forward to that. I'm going, oh boy, it's 4:30, time for the feature film. And then at 6 o'clock, I wake up. I don't have an alarm clock. Because I've really satisfied my need for sleep and for dreaming, I'm fully refreshed, and I just wake up automatically. Now, I know people have jobs, and they get penalized for showing up late, but waking up at six is probably good enough for most people, unless they're farmers and have to get up at 4 a.m. or something. But I would highly recommend that people try to wean themselves off of their alarm clock, because I think interrupting a cycle is probably detrimental to your health. And whether or not it's slow wave or REM sleep, you're not accumulating whatever it is that is provided by sleep.
I've always been amazed by our internal clock and the fact that I mostly don't need an alarm clock, you know, even when I've needed to get up for an appointment or something at a certain time. And I haven't always been brave enough to forgo the alarm clock, but all I have to do is know that I have to wake up at a certain time, and some part of my brain is tracking that, and I just seem to wake up at the appointed time.
Yeah. In fact, if I ever set an alarm clock, which I do occasionally, I invariably wake up a half an hour before the alarm clock goes off,
right.
In anticipation of being wakened by the alarm clock. But so anyway, so now we've established that you need 7.5 hours, not 8, and this idea that some people get by with 6 or even less, I think that's totally bogus. Edison is said to have been one of these people, but we know that Edison was a cokehead. You know, he was doing cocaine.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, just Google that. Edison. Okay. Edison on cocaine. He couldn't sleep. And then he supposedly he took all these naps during the day. He was constantly nodding out. At any rate, there have been a lot of people like that. They say, oh, he only needs 4 hours of sleep. And I don't think that's true. But at any rate, another concept I want to mention is this idea of a reservoir or a pool. We know that we need sleep, and we know that we need dream sleep, although I think that's a contradiction. I'll get to that in a minute. But so we have to constantly replenish these pools, and we don't know why. I remember when I first started studying sleep back in the 60s, I was amazed that nothing was known. I mean, here we are, one-third of our day, or 24 hours, is spent in this state that we hardly know anything about. And if you think about sleep from an evolutionary point of view, Most organisms have a period of quietude, or whatever you want to call it, where they kind of turn off for a while. And then in mammals, it gets more regularized. And so you got to believe, given that it takes up one third of our time, that there's something critically important going on there. And we do know that if people are chronically sleep deprived, they start showing symptoms. In fact, there's been these radio DJs who are going to stay up all week or something on around the clock and everything. They eventually become psychotic. And
if they didn't start out that way.
Yeah, if they weren't already. But I actually had an experience when I was very young, in my teens, where I was getting maybe 3 or 4 hours of sleep a night, because my girlfriend was visiting and she was in Virginia, and I had to got off of work at 9 o'clock at night and then drove to her place and made out or whatever it was that we were doing. And then I had to drive back, and it was usually like 2-3 o'clock in the morning. And then I had to get up and go back to work. And that went on for a number of days. And I experienced something that I have read about now, but at the time, it was totally bizarre. I was driving along on a back road, and I didn't fall asleep. Suddenly, what I was seeing turned into a completely different scene. It was a jungle scene, and I knew I was driving, and I knew enough to slowly put on the brakes and stop. But what I was seeing was an intrusion of a dream that was forcing me, against my will, to get some of this dream time. And I think that, and you know, that's where the psychosis comes in. I think if people are REM deprived over long periods of time, they start having intrusive dreams. There's such a demand for this reservoir of dream sleep that the body forces us into it if we don't get it. Now, I don't know how what that need is, and I really don't have a lot to say about that. It's obviously chemical in nature and so on and so forth. I also would like to propose that we settle this issue about REM versus dream. There are reports of dreams occurring in non-REM sleep, and I'm sure that's possibly true. But I think we should just call it dream time. I don't even think it's a form of sleep, because our brain is fully awake. Our body is paralyzed, literally. And we're in this dream state, but I don't think it's sleep. How could it be sleep if the brain is fully awake? At any rate, starting with that as a
some people have called it paradoxical sleep, in fact.
Yeah, that fits with my idea that it's something else.
Yeah.
So now let's switch to a conversation about getting into that state without going to sleep. And that's been called waking-induced lucid dreaming, and the other form is sleep-induced lucid dreaming. The name lucid dreaming is as good as any, as far as I'm concerned, and basically refers to the fact that you are having a dream, and in the dream you are aware that you're dreaming. And wonderful things can result if you get to this state. So what I'd like to do is just hopefully briefly describe what I do to get into this state. By the way, since we started talking about this stuff, I've been online quite a bit researching sleep and lucid dreaming and everything. I had no idea that there was such a huge body of literature out there. And I would recommend that any beginner just Google lucid dreaming and start working your way through it, and you'll find YouTube movies and all kinds of things that you can, resources that you can check out to inform yourself. Some of them are kind of crazy. Some of them are obviously trying to sell you something. You don't need a DVD or a CD or a special thing to put over your eyes and pulsate. You don't need any of that stuff. basically what you need is some time that you can set aside to try this. You can do it at night when you're in bed, but it's so hard because you're so used to falling right into your first slow wave cycle. Although I also contend, there's certainly no agreement about this, but I contend that every sleep session starts off with a bit of REM sleep. I noticed this in rats, by the way, when I used to do a lot of EEG recording with rats. When they first went to sleep, they went into a little tiny REM period. And I noticed it in myself. At any rate, so doing it at night is possible but difficult. What I recommend is, and this is great if you're retired, it's harder to do if you're working full time or if you have the demands of a family. But set aside a time in the afternoon where you can experiment with this and where you're not necessarily so sleep deprived that you're going to fall right to sleep. Also, don't get in your bed. I use my recliner, and there's a couple of reasons for that. For one, getting in bed is like preparation for doing your normal going into slow wave sleep, whereas getting in your recliner it kind of prevents that in some ways because you can't assume the position that you normally get into. Whatever it is, lying on your side or on back. Most people, I guess, sleep on their side. I read one thing that said men should sleep on their right side and women should sleep on their left side. And it has to do with some form of yoga. I don't know anything about it. But I've been told that sleeping on your right side is best because it doesn't compress your heart.
That's interesting because I've noticed that to fall asleep, I typically seem to have to sleep on my right side. When I'm flying on the airplane, I need to lean against the right-hand window, and I can sleep fine. Left-hand window doesn't work at all.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a combination of things, what we have learned to do, as well as maybe perhaps some natural inclination to avoid the idea that if you're sleeping on your left side, you're kind of squeezing your heart chamber down a little bit. That seems to be reasonable to me. But anyway, so if you're in your recliner, you're not able to get into that position. Okay, now, so you're in your recliner, it's quiet, it should be fairly dark in the room, doesn't have to be completely blackout, but fairly dark. And then comes the hard part, and that is paying attention. I believe the attention mechanism, whatever the heck that is critically important in all of this. And in fact, one of your previous doctors was talking about this. What was his name? Raymond, I think. Is that right?
It's not ringing a bell, but I know it's a thread that's run
through
a number of the interviews. And it was what my doctoral dissertation was about. And I was looking at my doctoral dissertation just before getting on with you to see if there was anything to bring in here. But go ahead.
Yeah, this guy's Ruben Naaman.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was the sleep guy, yeah.
Yeah, and it was number 256. I would recommend people go back and listen to that. Although he kind of doesn't really lock in on this on the 90-minute cycle idea. You mention it, and he kind of dismisses it. I think it's critically important. But anyway, that's he had some very interesting ideas, and with regard to categories and attention mechanism, because. Now you're in your recliner, you've closed your eyes, but you have not stopped looking, and that's a critical part. You're still looking into the void. What do you see? Well, what I see is just a homogeneous field, kind of a velvety purple with maybe some green in it. And you just have to keep looking at that, and it's boring. There's nothing going on. Yeah. So you think. So you're looking at that and looking at that, inevitably your mind will wander. You know, the monkey brain will start chattering and you'll start thinking about other things. And then you have to bring yourself back to looking into the void. Usually when you close your eyes, you're used to turning off your looking mechanism, whatever that is. And in fact, if you open the eyelids of a sleeping person, you see their eyes are crossed, which is kind of strange. But at any rate, don't cross your eyes. Keep looking. Try to be sensitive to any subtle changes that you might see. You might see a swirling. You might see a different color. Maybe it'll slowly change into a more dark green or more towards red or whatever. You may also see a flash of light occasionally, a little pinpoint. Now, what I believe is that you're in a condition where you're looking for visual input and you're not getting any. Something similar happened to me one time when I was in an experimental chamber working on setting up some experiments, and there was loud white noise in the chamber. And what I discovered was that within minutes, I would start hearing voices. And I think this is analogous because I think you're expecting visual input, you're not getting any, and your brain, in the absence of input, see, it doesn't seem to like that state, so it starts inventing its own. And I think that's what will ease you into this lucid dreaming state. So anyway, you're looking around, nothing's happening, maybe start to see swirling. Now, at that point, it may help to imagine what it is you want to see. I've had the most success imagining a particular person's face. We already know that there are areas of the brain devoted to face recognition, and faces are very important to us. So an easy way to start is to try to call up a particular person's face. You can also try to call up anything else, a car, a toaster. Yesterday I was trying to call up a piece of bread, you know, just to experiment. I thought of toaster and then I thought, no, that's too commonplace. I think I'll try a piece of bread. But it may be more difficult, so I suggest starting with a face. Okay, so it's still swirling around. Perhaps by now you're starting to see something more than the homogeneous state. You can see distinct patterns of some kind swirling about, and then perhaps an indistinct face. Now, the strange thing about it is, every time I do a face, I'm always slightly surprised that when the face does appear, it's not like a mugshot. It's not looking right at me. It might be looking in the opposite direction. It might be the back of the person's head. It might be something, you know, a medium shot rather than a close-up or whatever. But eventually, in my case, I'm usually able to conjure that person up. And as I begin to recognize their face, it suddenly snaps into clarity. And I mean clarity. I'm not talking about, oh, you know, fuzzy. I'm talking about sharp focus.
Wow.
And there they are. And there you are. And at first, and you said something about this in the past, about being so surprised that it wakes you up.
Yes, that's been my pitfall.
And I've seen that in the literature, by the way. People talk about that. And so maybe that'll jar you out of your reverie, or maybe not, but you want to keep trying to stick with it. And that's the other thing. Persistence pays off. And give it more than 5 minutes. Give it a half an hour at least. And if you don't fall asleep, and if you don't have any hypnagogic effect, well, okay, give up and try it again. And once again, people who write about this suggests that persistence is the biggest part of all of it, and I happen to agree. I mean, I kind of fell into it accidentally, but so it doesn't work every time for me. I have another theory, and that back to the pool, the reservoir of REM sleep versus and the pool of slow wave sleep. It seems to me, and I tried to verify this, and once I started getting really regular good sleep, it seemed to be harder to get into the lucid dreaming state from wakefulness. And I thought, wow, that's interesting. Maybe the REM reservoir is completely filled up and it doesn't need any more. And it's, so it's harder for me to get there. After a few days of testing that theory, I had an experience where I came back from a film shoot late at night. And when I got in bed and started my little reverie, boy, the whole scene was blowing up. I mean, it wasn't some homogeneous screen. It was just all kinds of stuff happening. Also, I think I've mentioned in the past that whatever drugs you may have taken, including caffeine and nicotine, as well as THC or anything else, for me, makes a difference in what I see when I close my eyes. If that scene could be externalized onto a little LCD, it would be like a fantastic drug test. Oh, he's been smoking pot. Oh, too much caffeine. You're not going to, and especially alcohol. Back when I used to drink alcohol before going to bed, I inevitably would see black and white, what shall I call them? Shooters, streams, flashes, lightning, just practically like lightning going back and forth. So I, and also I want to talk briefly about doing this when you're sick and when you have a fever. I've tried that recently, and strangely enough, when I had a fever, every time I tried to go into this state, I saw this little square logo. I think I mentioned it before. It was kind of like the shrink wrap radio logo.
Oh, good, good.
But it wasn't really that. It was like a little sign. It had symbols on it. I couldn't tell what they meant, but it was like, oh, you're sick. Don't go any further. You don't need to try this when you're sick. And I don't know if that was, it happened two or three times and it was always the same little symbol, but I can't imagine that that's really, really something very real. But anyway, back to your experiment. Let's say you're now seeing faces. You thought about your old girlfriend and there she is in person. And so you should imagine you're talking to her. And what do you know? She will talk back and she will start saying things that you may not want to hear, or maybe you do want to hear them. I don't know. And then if you get into it, the scene will enlarge and it'll take up your whole visual field and you'll be in the dream. What happens from there on? It can go a number of different ways. I notice in the literature that people talk about lucid dreaming as a learned skill, and that you have to keep practicing and you get better and better at it and you learn something. Just yesterday, I came up with the idea that it's not really any different from normal dreaming. It's just that in a normal dream, you're conditioned to be a silent observer. You're having a dream. It's not a lucid dream. You're just having a regular old dream. And all kinds of stuff is happening. You're in the dream to the extent that you're observing it, but you're not trying to control it. You're not exerting yourself. Maybe you're not even talking. You're not saying anything. You're just a silent observer. And I think that's the normal situation for dreaming. What I think is different about lucid dreaming is that you've made a conscious decision to stop being silent and to express yourself, to say something or to express a desire. I'd like to fly. And then you start flying. In the past, maybe you've had episodes of flying in a dream, But you never said, I want to fly. You just found yourself flying, accidentally.
Yeah, you might say in the one case that the dream is having you, and then in the other one where you're a more active participant, you're having the dream.
Exactly. That's a good way to put it. I like that. So normally you're just a passive, okay, the dream is having you and all kinds of weird stuff is happening and you're going like, well, I mean, you're not even reflecting on it. It's just going on. In a lucid dream, you are consciously deciding to do this or that, go here or there, change the scene. I've had a situation I think I mentioned before where some people were talking and I was viewing them from above and it was kind of like a film director. And I was going like, well, this is totally boring. So I said, cut. And they all stopped and looked up. And I said, you know, this is a boring conversation. Could we liven it up by talking about, and I mentioned something else. And they said, okay. And then they went on with their conversation. Now they were discussing something I found interesting.
Now, let me check in with you here because what I've read about this would suggest that, yes, you can have some control. And at the same time, there are autonomous things that are going on and unfolding that you didn't necessarily control. So, for example, you gave the example of your girlfriend who might come up in this lucid dream, might say things you are interested in hearing or might say things that you didn't want to hear.
That's an amazing part of all of this. Two aspects of it. One, The other players seem to have wills of their own. They're not robots. They're not just waiting for your instructions. They're going along doing their thing and saying whatever the hell they want to say, whether you like it or not. You know? Now, right. You can say, you might scream out, cut, I don't want to see that, I don't want to go there, I want to be in a different place. You might leave that scene and go to another. But I'm always amazed at how complete the other individuals are. They have personalities. They may be like they used to be. They may be different. I've spent a lot of time communicating with dead people, and often they're dead. I remember my father used to come back in my dreams, and I would say, "Hey, Dad, how you doing?" And he seemed weird I don't know how to describe it. He wasn't his old self. And then I would say to myself, oh, that's right, you're dead. I can't expect too much out of you because you're dead. But he would still, he wasn't a zombie, but he would talk, but he was always a little bit less lively than he had been in real life. And by the way, I haven't really spent a lot of time asking these people about the future or trying to test who they actually were. You know, if they looked like the person, I just assumed that they were the person. I have had people come back and be dead people come back and be partly rotted away. And that's kind of hard to take.
Yeah, that sounds scary.
Some of this can be scary. And I should mention my good friend and partner who, years ago, I was telling her all about this and going, my God, this is really exciting. And she's into Native American shamanism, and there's a lot of kind of similar stuff there. And she said, oh, yeah, okay, I'll try it. So I explained to her what I'm talking about now. The next day, she came back and said, I'm never going to do that again. And I said, why? And she said, oh, it was way too scary. I said, well, what happened? She said, well, I started in, just like you said. And then she said, it was like I was being projected. It wasn't like I was flying. It was like I was zooming in the dark. And by the way, other people report this as a transitional state, a feeling of falling or a feeling of rapid acceleration. Some people report a vibration that vibrates their whole body. But she said, once I went into it, it was so scary because I didn't think I could come back. And I immediately woke up, and I don't want to try that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, I mean, you're just inside of your head, you know, you're not. But then I thought, well, you know, maybe this could be a doorway into madness. Who is to say, you know, certainly not me. I mean, I kind of use it as a playful adventure. Although one time I was in a lucid dream and I said, I wonder if I can conjure up something frightening. And instantaneously, almost before I finished that thought, something frightening was about 2 inches from my face, and it scared the hell out of me. It caused me to have a visceral reaction so much that it woke me up. And I said, well, I guess I don't need to try that anymore.
Yeah, really.
Or you could try some versions of that, you know, things that may have been bothering you, or, you know, you don't have to want to see a monster in your face, but, there may be some limits to this for some people. And by the way, I should reinforce the fact that I am not an expert by any means. I'm merely a practitioner, and I'm just telling you about my personal experiences, and I'm not even going so far as to recommend this for everyone. I do think it's a lot of fun. And I have a lot of fun with it. And for me, like I said, it's a feature film deal, because what I, even though I'm talking now about the waking induced lucid dream, the sleep induced lucid dream, usually the feature film, I've kind of transitioned into lucid dreaming almost all the time. If I'm having my normal 90-minute feature film, I'm in there trying to exert some control over it. Sometimes I just let it go. I mean, I don't feel a need to control it. Sometimes how did you put it? The dream is having me.
Yeah.
Instead of my having the dream. And I just let it go at that. But I've also discovered that it's pretty easy to transition. I don't do the looking at my hands thing or looking at the ground. A lot of people have these different methodologies that they recommend for getting into the state. I can't say that I'm always aware that I'm dreaming when I'm dreaming, but when I want to become aware, it doesn't seem to involve any special trick for me. So a lot of times I'll have a lucid dream, without any special desire to go into a lucid dream. I'll just be dreaming, and then I'll just say, oh, well, I think I want to fly, or I want to go over here. In fact, you know, you and I both explored Second Life.
Right, the online virtual reality game.
Yeah, and truthfully, I think that's really close to the dream state. You can fly, you can control your environment, you can jump from here to there. There are other weird people roaming around doing weird things. You can be as weird as you want. You can change your avatar into anything you want. So it's kind of similar to that in a way, although I don't think it involves some kind of REM state. I just think it's interesting that it's kind of like a online version of a lucid dream. At any rate, back to the practical experience. Now you're wandering around in your dream. Sometimes you just let it go. It unfolds on its own. Sometimes you're intent upon doing something. As people in the literature, you'll see all kinds of accounts of people flying and changing the whole scene. Now I want to be on Mars, or now I want to be in Africa, or whatever. And you can try those things out. When I'm in a dream, I'm not very radical. It seems like things I try out are not really radically experimental. I just don't seem to be drawn to that. I'm more interested in talking to people, listening to what they have to say and what they're up to. And I've had a number of these experiences. I don't know how useful it is to recount some of them, but let's see. I've got some of them. I do keep a dream log, and
are you contrasting the ones that occur during your dream sleep to the ones that are in the afternoon in your easy chair that you're more experimental, more adventurous in the easy chair than the sleep time dreams?
I can't say that I really notice a difference.
Oh, okay.
In fact, now that you've mentioned that, maybe I should set an agenda for the wakeful transition into. Maybe I should say, okay, today I'm going to be exploring different body shapes for myself. You know, I'm going to be really huge. I'm going to be a giant stalking across the land. You know.
Well, I keep wondering about healing, and. You know, what might be accomplished in terms of working on one's body, one's illnesses, if it were possible to go in and very vividly experience the internal world and have that somehow impact, you know, if you were to able to visualize an area of concern in your body and somehow try to affect those processes.
Yeah. In fact, that brings me to another point. Your Wagner, Lucid Dreaming number 189, he goes into his description of five stages because he's actually on a mission to try to uncover the inner self, the psyche or whatever you want to call it. I haven't really gone that far into it. And in fact, his five stages, I guess I would say I'm still in stage one. I hate to admit it, but I'm still playing around in the sandbox. You know?
Yeah.
I'm using it for entertainment and fun. Now, and once again, I went back and listened to that one, and I was going like, well, maybe I'm just lazy, and I should start going to stage two and three and four, trying to, and he eventually gets to the white light, which he relates to the Buddhist practices. And I don't know if I don't have any desire to go there, or maybe there's something in there that I don't want to find out, or what it is, but I've been disinclined to try to use it as the so-called door to the unconscious.
Door to enlightenment or spiritual advancement.
Yeah, because I'm not sure I believe in spiritual advancement. But
yeah.
But I don't know. Maybe I'm just lazy. And listening to his discussion gave me a little incentive to maybe try to check some of that out further, you know, how to move on to stage two. And I didn't even write down the stages, so I can't mention them. But he does see it as making progress towards true enlightenment.
Yeah, you know, in the Zen literature, they talk about, because what you're talking about sounds a lot like meditation, you know, when you talk about fixing your attention on something. And in this case, you're fixing your attention on the visual channel, which is probably different than a lot of meditation, except there are these meditations where people focus on a mandala or some other kind of visual pattern. So actually that's in there too. In the Japanese Zen tradition, as I understand it, they teach people that, hey, you're going to have visions, you're going to have these intrusive images that are going to come in, but they do look at them as intrusions rather than, in other words, their message would be, don't get distracted by the sandbox. That's not where the real payoff is. You need to go beyond the sandbox and not get distracted by that. You know, so that is one view. That's another view.
Yeah, and I can relate to that. It's just that I haven't chosen to go down that path. And speaking of intrusions, there's something else I wanted to mention in my own experience. Again, let's go back to where I'm starting to see images in the swirling velvet cave that I'm staring into. Occasionally, I'll get a full-blown image from someplace else that just takes over. It's kind of like picture in picture on the TV, you know?
Yeah.
And suddenly, I remember recently I had one where suddenly there was a scene, a detailed, crisp scene. I was looking down from above and a child was playing on a picnic blanket. And I remember being totally amazed at my brain's ability to conjure up a scene that was complete in every detail, down to the pattern on the blanket, the blades of grass, the leaves on the tree. Everything was complete and finished and in sharp focus. Well, sometimes that happens to me when I'm in the midst of the swirling image. I think those are coming from two different places in the brain. Normally, visual input from the eyes, and by the way, I would encourage listeners to take a look at the brain online that shows the eyeballs, because the eyeballs are made out of brain material, and they're just these stalks coming out of the brain with an eyeball on the end of each yeah, stalk.
Right.
And it's so weird looking. You're going like, oh, okay, I see how that works. This is a direct connection
yeah.
from the outside world visually into my brain. But the path of that, and once again, Hameroff talks about this back in his quantum consciousness. The path is there are a number of branches in the path. Part of it goes back to the visual cortex, which is in the back of the brain, but other parts go to other parts of the brain first. And the visual cortex takes a couple of milliseconds to actually get online. Sometimes I think these images are coming from my, quote, mind's eye, unquote, rather than from my visual input from the cave. And they seem to be able to intrude. I seem to be able to reject them and make them go away. Or sometimes they take over completely. And it has nothing to do with what I was trying to pull up in my hypnagogic state. It's just like, boom, here's a whole new thing that you're looking at. And something else is going on.
Yeah, so of course, other people have interpreted this in a different way. I mean, you're relating it to your brain and to a naturalistic understanding of the world. There are other people who've taken it more literally, right, and said, wow, these are beings from another dimension who I'm somehow contacting and experiencing. I wanted to throw into our discussion, I don't know if I've ever mentioned him before, Emanuel Swedenborg. A Swedish, I looked him up on Wikipedia just before yeah. our conversation here. Got turned on to him by a book written by Wilson Van Dusen years ago, who was kind of a Swedenborgian. And Emanuel Swedenborg was, he lived from 1688 to 1772, and he's described as a Swedish scientist, philosopher, theologian and Christian mystic. And he also cultivated this ability, as I understand it, to enter the hypnagogic world. And there he discovered a hierarchy of beings that seemed mm-hmm. to range all the way from angels and divine presences at the top to demonic ones way down at the bottom. And so he developed a whole theology based on that. Then I'm also remembering John Lilly, the dolphin guy.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And people who are not as old as we are may not remember the amazing John Lilly who ventured out so far as he was very much involved in experimenting with sensory deprivation. And he developed the sensory deprivation tank where he was floating in body temperature water in complete darkness. And then he took it another step further and started taking LSD with it.
Right.
And and he also experienced then beings, you know, coming in from other dimensions and so on. And then there are the people who are channeled. Somehow this must be related to the phenomenon of channeling, and people who have whole books that they produce that they claim you know, came from some autonomous other source. So to me, I find it equally amazing whether, in fact, it's from some other dimension, spiritual or otherwise, or it's from our brain, and there are these autonomous personalities swirling around somewhere in our brain. Either one is pretty mind-blowing.
Yeah, I totally agree. And harking back to that sensory deprivation, I think that's exactly what this is, you're depriving yourself of visual input while you're awake, and your brain starts to invent stuff, and that's the lucid dream. I mean, you're not immersed in body temperature water or anything like that. But in fact, I wonder if they still have those tanks. I'd be interested in getting one.
Well, I'll bet they're out there somewhere. You know, you could probably find a used one.
Yeah, right, Craigslist.
I got in one. I have to say that I did have a chance to plunk down some money. There were places that you could go, and for $25 or $50 or $100, I don't remember how much it was, you could have an hour experience. Uh-huh. And I did, but I didn't have any fantastic experience. And that sort of brings me to another point, is that I suspect that this is, you know, like other human traits and abilities, this is maybe normally distributed, that some people are going to have a much more easy access to these sorts of altered states than other people will. What do you think about that?
I think it's probably true. Most everything else distributes on a normal curve, so why not this? And it may also be related to your past experiences with psychedelics and psychotropic drugs of some kind or another.
Yeah, and also your cultural experience. I mean, if you grow up in a tribal situation where, for example, trance is, you know, a regular mm-hmm. thing induced mm-hmm. by various ceremonial practices, then I would, maybe everybody in that society or most people are able to access that. We grow up in a society in which the inner world tends to be minimized.
Exactly. In fact, the Australian Aborigines obviously spend a lot of dream time. They call it dream time, and they do all kinds of amazing things, including out of body travel, which I think is part of the same thing. In fact, who was it? I did buy a book, Thomas Juszczyk, Advanced Lucid Dreaming, The Power of Supplements. I have to give credit to John Conaway, who sent me an email regarding this, the whole idea, because I made the statement that I didn't know of any drugs that enhanced dreaming. It seemed like all normal, regular drugs depressed dreaming. And so John turned me on to this whole new idea of taking supplements, natural supplements, and for those so inclined, how to induce high-level lucid dreams and out-of-body experiences, I would recommend his book. I have skimmed it. I haven't gone fully into it, but that didn't stop me from ordering one of these supplements called Lucid Dreamer. And once again, listeners can Google that and find it. So I sent off an order, and I got some of the stuff. And of course, I didn't read the instructions first, which I should have done. Yeah. But I must say, it had a definite effect. I took one before I went to bed, and then that night, I woke up at one of my regular times, and I said, "Wow, that really made a difference. I'm going to have to remember this." And I was going like, "Yeah, it really made a difference." So when I woke up, then finally in the morning, I was going like, "Wow, it really made a difference. What was the difference?" Yeah. I don't remember.
Right. And I should mention John Conway is one of our listeners who didn't quite spell that out.
Oh, no. And in fact, he, I hate it when this happens. It always happens to me. You think you're into something new, and then you discover it's not new at all, and other people know a lot more than you do about it and have been practicing and doing all this stuff. And John was nice enough to relate some of his experiences. And what I'd learned, by the way, when I did go back and read the instructions, was that I should have taken that pill between cycle 4 and 5. That it kind of jazzes you up a little bit.
Interesting idea.
Yeah, to go into, and in my own experience, this is kind of a poor man's version. Sometimes if I wake up after cycle 4, it's 4:30 in the morning, and I feel like I can't get back to sleep, so I'll just get up, and then I inevitably have a cup of coffee and sit down at the computer, and then about an hour and a half later, I feel this wave of drowsiness come over me, and I go back to sleep, and now I have caffeinated dreams, and they're kind of fun too, because it's like it's like dreaming on coffee.
Yeah. Now, you know, we're about to run out of time here, and I mentioned one listener, and I heard from one or two who sort of called to mind Jung and his thoughts on what he called active imagination.
Yeah, and, what's that about?
Well, I hadn't made that link, but I guess it really does fit. And I went to, as always, I went to Wikipedia.
Right.
And let me just read you a little bit from there. It says, sure. Active imagination is a concept developed by Carl Jung between 1913 and 1916. It's a meditation technique wherein the contents of one's unconscious are translated into images, narrative, or personified as separate entities. It can serve as a bridge between the conscious ego and the unconscious and includes working with dreams and the creative self via imagination or fantasy. Jung linked active imagination with the process of alchemy, and that both strive for oneness and the interrelatedness from a set of fragmented and dissociated parts. So far, that kind of fits with everything that we've been saying. It goes on to say, key to the process of active imagination is the goal of exerting as little influence as possible. Now, that's the difference, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
Exerting as little influence as possible on mental images as they unfold. For example, if a person were recording a spoken visualization of a scene or object from a dream, Jung's approach would ask the practitioner to observe the scene, watch for changes, and report them rather than to consciously fill the scene with one's desired changes. One would then respond genuinely to these changes and report any further changes in the scene. This approach is meant to ensure that the unconscious contents express themselves without overbearing influence from the conscious mind. At the same time, however, Jung was insistent that some form of participation in active imagination was essential. Quote, you yourself must enter into the process with your personal reactions as if the drama being enacted before your eyes were real, close quote. So all of, and it goes on from there. People can go to Wikipedia to read more. That seems accurate based on what I've, you know, read and of Jung and so on. So it's a good summary.
Yeah, very interesting. In fact, I realize you could spend a lifetime studying and researching this whole thing on the internet, and Wikipedia is always the, which, by the way, Wikipedia is the largest endeavor ever undertaken by mankind. It has involved more people than the building of the pyramids and so on and so forth. But there's so much more to be discussed. I think we pretty much covered the basics. I did want to mention one thing, and that's sleep paralysis. During normal sleep, when you go into a dream, it's like there's a switch in the midbrain someplace that gets thrown, which basically paralyzes your body. Now, I think this is probably a protection to keep you from getting up and sleepwalking. and some people have a leaky switch or a leaky valve there,
right,
and that,
right.
And that, so they walk around and stuff. But when you experience this in one of your sessions, it can be kind of scary. One time I was in the recliner, and I came out of the dream, and I couldn't move. And I was going like, oh, no, I've become a paralyzed person by accident. And it just lasted for maybe 30 seconds,
yeah.
and then I was able to move. But more recently, I had a regular dream, and I got into lucid dreaming. And then I don't know what it was in the dream that woke me up, but I tried to sit up and I was more or less paralyzed, although I was finally able to actually sit up in bed, but then I fell over and I was going like, oh no, I'm paralyzed. And I tried again and it was like, it's kind of like in a dream when you're trying to run and you can't really run. It's real slow motion kind
yeah.
of stuff. It's kind of like that. After the second little episode there, then I fully woke up and I wasn't paralyzed and I was very happy about that. But it can be scary if you get into that. I'm just relating it so that people won't be surprised if that happens. It's not permanent. Don't worry about it.
Okay. Well, we probably need to wrap it up at this point. This is going to be an ongoing conversation, I can tell.
Well, listen, it's always great talking with you, Dave. And I really, really admire what you're doing with Shrink Wrap Radio. It certainly has kept me in touch with psychology. And longtime listeners may recall that I was once working on my PhD, and I kind of got blackballed and all that kind of stuff. But it serves as my portal into the modern world of psychology. Some of your people that you interview are so interesting that I buy the book or I go and do more research, and I have to commend you on this this vast undertaking. I mean, what number are you up to by now? 280 something?
Not quite that high, but if you add the Wise Counsel, it's well over 300.
Yeah, and I do, by the way. Now I always check out Wise Counsel as well. It's a little bit straighter. In some regards,
yeah, but deliberately.
Nonetheless, it's always very informative, and I have to thank you for that. It's been great being I've listened to every single one.
Well, I thank you for that, certainly, and that's really helped to support my whole journey. And I am so pleased to be able to share you and our friendship and the way it enlivens me with our audience. So. We will definitely be back and better wrap it up at this point.
Okay.
Okay. So thanks a lot.
Okay, Dave. Thank you. Bye.
Okay. So that's it. Jerry and I hope you found it stimulating. As always, send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave comments about individual shows, including this one, in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails on Skype, where I'm ShrinkPod, or voicemail on our phone at 206-337-0622. And as I promised last time, on the next episode, you really will hear Rupert Isaacson, director and author of film and book, respectively, The Horse Boy. After my discussion with Jerry, you know, it really is all in your mind. ¶¶